Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What animal can move through the water at an astonishing 60 miles per hour, hunt its prey both at the surface of the ocean and at great depths, and command respect and perhaps some healthy fear from even the best-equipped sport fishermen? 10 points if you said swordfish, a prized catch for centuries and an enduring model of aquatic elegance, strength, and fearlessness. My guest today has long been impressed by the beauty of these animals and fascinated to know that biologists are still learning new things about them. Richard Ellis is a painter of marine natural history and author of the new book Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What do we know about the earliest human encounters with swordfish?
In North America, there were people that were known as the Red Paint People about 5,000 years ago on the coast of Maine, who used to, it appears, used to hunt swordfish from open boats, harpoon them in the open ocean, and then drag them back and butcher them and eat them on the shore. We know this because there are kitchen middens. There are evidence of swordfish swords buried deep in the on the beaches, and along with evidence of these people. So they were probably, at least in North America, the first people to hunt swordfish. Swordfish are also very popular now and 5,000 years ago in the Mediterranean. So it has long been a favored food item of human beings.
But incredibly dangerous to acquire.
Well, it all depends. It all depends on how you plan to acquire them. If you're a fisherman and you're dragging a lure along the surface of the sea, it's not that dangerous to acquire. If you're a longline fisherman trying to acquire swordfish, it is even less dangerous to acquire. On the other hand, for some longline fishermen, and think of the movie Perfect Storm, in the movie Perfect Storm, the fishermen portrayed were longline fishermen, and they went far offshore because they weren't catching enough fish closer to shore. They went far offshore, and ultimately, as everybody remembers from this movie, they were sunk, but not by swordfish, by the perfect storm, the congregation of two or three, I think it is, storms at once. So it's not dangerous per se. I mean, the sword of the swordfish is not something that is going to endanger a fisherman necessarily. But on the other hand, the swordfish uses its sword for a whole lot of other strange things that we don't really understand.
Yeah, talk about that, because there have been all kinds of crazy, over the years, apocryphal reports of how these really spectacular bills might be used. Turns out they don't sort of joust one another or fence one another.
Yeah, but that would be the obvious apocryphal story. The stories that are not apocryphal, which are just as mysterious, are told about swordfish stabbing things.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, somebody sent me a photograph of a fish taken broadside. It was a fish with a very tall dorsal fin and a big spike sticking out of the front of its nose. And he said, "Can you identify this fish?" And I said, "Of course I can. That's the swordfish." Then he sent me another photograph. The other photograph was the same fish. It had turned around 90 degrees, and it was aimed straight at him.
Hmm.
What it did was it stabbed him. This fish, off Hawaii, the man's name was Mark Ferrari, off Hawaii, he's a whale researcher, and he was diving with whales when he saw this fish and thought, "This is cool, I'll just photograph this fish." What he didn't expect is the fish to aim right at him and stab him. It stabbed him just below the clavicle, nearly killed him, and he lived to tell the story, obviously. But In addition to that, there is an enormous amount of physical evidence rendering these stories far from apocryphal. Physical evidence of swordfish stabbing things. Now, I'll get to why they might do that, even though I have no idea, but I'll make something up. but in fact, there's a book. I'm looking at it now and preparation for this interview. The book is called The Alleged Pugnacity of Swordfish and Their Attacks on Vessels. And what it is a scientific paper with photograph after photograph of the timbers of ships pierced by swordfish swords, which ultimately end up with the sword breaking off and presumably, even though we don't have the rest of the evidence, presumably the swordfish dying after it breaks off a very important part of its anatomy. There are photographs and eyewitness accounts of swordfish stabbing submersibles. The famous Woods Hole submersible, the Alvin, was down at 2,000 feet when, you know, this is the submersible from which they discovered the Titanic. Mm-hmm. So they're competent people aboard. They were down at about 2,000 feet. They looked out through the little porthole, and bang, a swordfish stabbed the submersible. Now, whatever else the swordfish had in mind, it certainly wasn't going to eat it. So there's that. The swordfish got stuck in the submersible. The submersible was brought to the surface. They cut the swordfish out and cooked it and ate it. There have been any number of submersible observations of swordfish, and probably the most dramatic of all is something you can Google right now. If you're sitting in a position to Google YouTube swordfish in oil rig, you will see the following. There's a blowout preventer like the one that they kept filming during the BP oil spill, so it's not that deep. And in this blowout preventer, in the pipes and rigging of the blowout preventer, there's a swordfish stuck in it. And it's flailing around. It's got a sword stuck in two pieces of the blowout preventer. It's frantic. Fish like that can't swim backwards. Very few fish can swim backwards. But this one is stuck there. So they deploy a kind of a grabber. One assumes it was the kind of thing used to move and remove pipes as part of the blowout preventer. And they grab the swordfish by the base of its tail, and they pull it out. And you say to yourself, hooray, the swordfish is saved, at which point the swordfish turns right around and dives right back into the blowout preventer and impales the blowout preventer again. They pull it out again, and this time the swordfish wiggles off and disappears into the darkness. Why they are stabbing blowout preventers, submersibles, ships? There are records of swordfish swords being embedded 18 inches into the timbers of a ship. 18 inches into the timbers of a ship. As I said, I was going to make something up, but I can't even make this up because there is no explanation for it. Swordfish, number one, have no teeth. And therefore, whatever was in the mind of the swordfish, and we'll get to that part soon, but whatever was in the mind of the swordfish was certainly not to eat the submersible or the boat or Mark Ferrari, because it couldn't have eaten him anyway. Mm-hmm. And so here we have this long, and there are also reports of swordfish stabbing whales. They know that because they bring the whales aboard. Whalers would do this. Bring the whales aboard, start to cut them up, and what would they find in the whale? A broken-off swordfish sword. Now, a swordfish maximum at its largest weighs maybe 1,100 pounds. A whale at its maximum, the biggest whale, of course, weighs 200 tons. There's not much of a contest between a 200-ton animal and a fish with no teeth. So here's another one. There's another example of swordfish doing this. Now, the problem really is, well, it's a big biological problem. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book. The problem is we can't make any sense out of this. It is almost, and may even be, suicidal. If you're attacking something with a very important part of your anatomy and it's going to break off, you're going to die when you do this. You're not going to get, not only are you not going to get anything to eat, you're never going to get anything to eat again.
So is it just rogue swordfish that do this sort of thing?
No, there couldn't be rogue swordfish because it happens so often. The other thing that is so curious about many of the attacks is that they take place in very, very deep water. At one point, people believed, hunters, the people in the Mediterranean 5,000 years ago, would be sailing on their little ocean, and they would see fish swimming at the surface, these great big swordfish, dorsal fins sticking out of the water, and they would harpoon them. Terrific. This is a great way to catch fish, as far as the Greeks and the Romans were concerned. Great way to catch fish. The trouble with this idea was that they then discovered that swordfish are very, very deep water fishes. They hunt, they swim at the surface to sun themselves, and then they dive down to 2,000 or 3,000 feet. That's where the Alvin was stabbed. That's where the Johnson Sea Link was stabbed by a swordfish. And they spend most of their time 2,000 feet down. And, surprisingly enough, they are well equipped to do that. There was a story on the internet, 4 or 5 months ago, maybe more. It showed a picture of two hands holding a great big eye. A lot of people saw this, and there was a controversy as to, I mean, an eye the size of a cantaloupe.
Yeah.
And the controversy was, what could this possibly be? Well, I had been, at that point, I had been working on a documentary about the giant squid, which was shown in January of this year. And so people decided, oh, an eye that big must be the giant squid, the biggest eye of any animal that ever lived. The trouble with it was cornflower blue. Hmm. And the only animal with a great big eye that is cornflower blue is our friend, the broadbill swordfish.
So why do they have these amazing eyes?
Exactly, because they like to hunt. Well, like is not the right word, because they hunt mm-hmm. at 2,000 or 3,000 feet down. They need the they have probably the best developed eye of any vertebrate in the world. Hmm. And the swordfish has a lot of other wonderful sort of superlative characteristics, but here's this eye. If you make your hands into a grapefruit-sized thing and then imagine it bright blue, like a bright blue marble, that's what the swordfish's eye looks like. So, by the way, P.S., the swordfish, like some other fishes, like the tuna and some sharks, has an interior warming system, a countercurrent warming system. Sharks, great white sharks, and makos and tuna have a system that warms their muscles, that makes them more efficient as predators. Swordfish have the same thing, but swordfish also have a system that heats their eyes. Hmm. So it's cold at 2,000 feet down. But at 2,000 feet down, the swordfish with these fabulous blue eyes, as well as a heating device to make the eyes more efficient so they don't seize up in the cold, is just this marvelous creature that has evolved into this superlative hunter.
And their eyes are so amazing that new fishermen used to be told before they had seen their first swordfish, whatever you do, don't look at its eye because you will sort of miss your chance.
Well, you won't miss your chance. Peter Matheson wrote, don't look at its eye because you'll fall in love with it. And you couldn't possibly, because he was talking about harpooning, you couldn't possibly kill an animal with eyes like that. It'd be like harpooning a puppy. So he told you not to do it for that reason. I don't think there's much to the fish will hypnotize you with its eyes, although, you know, swordfish do all these wonderful things, probably could do that too.
My guest is Richard Ellis. He is a painter of marine natural history and author of the new book Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. You can be part of this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Ellis. He is a painter of marine natural history and author of the new book Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Richard, a swordfish gets hungry. What's on the menu, and how does this animal go about procuring the food it wants to eat?
Well, the answer to question number one is fairly easy to answer. What's on the menu, you can learn, because people have been catching swordfish for thousands of years. When they catch them, they cut them open, and they see what's in their stomach. So mm-hmm. they say, well, they eat squid, and they eat small fishes, and this is fairly obvious. The rest of the question, not so much. The rest of the question requires a great leap to try and figure out how these small fishes and squid, some of which are not so small, how they get into the swordfish's stomach. Remember, step one is the swordfish has no teeth. So it can't swim around necessarily and grab these little fishes and squid and swallow them. It could, I suppose, but there's a lot of them. So what has been assumed for many, many years, remember what its name is, it's called the swordfish. So it's got a sword, and it's got this big thing sticking out of the front of its face. It's flat, though. It's flat like a broadsword. The sword or the bill of marlins is round. It's round and pointed. It's sort of an extended pointed cone. But the sword of a swordfish is flat. And the sides of that, like a broadsword, are relatively sharp. I mean, you wouldn't cut yourself if you ran your finger along it, but it's relatively sharp. So now you've got a fish with a flat sword sticking out of the front of its face. And the assumption has been for a very long time, well, the swordfish swam into a school of fish and tossed its sword around, bang, 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 and hit some fish with its sword and then gobbled them up. Probably correct, except that if you picture a flattened sword, horizontally flattened, and fishes swimming around in front of it, the fishes are also sort of horizontally flattened. They're not swimming vertically, so the swordfish can't chop them in half. So the swordfish is kind of flailing its sword around in fishes that are not necessarily easy to chop. Nonetheless, that's what's inside the swordfish's tummy, so somehow or other, that is made to work. What it doesn't do, it does not stab its prey. Mm-hmm. Because think about it. What would it do with a little fish on the end of its nose? That's not a good plan.
You got to then pry it off somehow, which doesn't seem
practical.
Well,
unless it had its girlfriend or his wife pry it off for him, but he mm-hmm. couldn't get it off by himself. I mean, he could shake it off, I suppose. That would be a highly energy-intensive way to eat a small fish.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is, again, one of the great and wonderful mysteries of swordfish. In fact, when I started this book, I've written books about a lot of sea creatures, from whales and sharks to dolphins and porpoises and squid and a lot of other things. And I just became fascinated initially, as I said, by the idea of swordfish stabbing things. But as I got further into the study of the biology and history of the swordfish, I realized that this creature is unique. It has a lot of elements in its biology that we don't understand. We don't understand these big blue eyes. Other deep-sea fishes don't have great big blue eyes. No other billfish, marlins, sailfish, no other billfish has this flattened sword. They just do things that are so, I don't know whether you can be more unique or less unique, but are unique. And so as I got into the study of swordfish, I became further enchanted by this creature that can do probably everything better and faster and stronger than most other fish in the sea, except for one. There's a fish that preys on the swordfish, and that's the mako. Mako sharks are known to attack swordfish, and swordfish are, as I pointed out, not known to attack much. They would rather get away, but makos are as fast as swordfish. And so we're facing this kind of conflict between a very big, very aggressive shark and a very big fish that may be aggressive or may not be. But for the most part, swordfish lead lives of swordfishery desperation, living the way swordfish do, whatever that is, and eating what they eat. But there's just so much about them that is astonishing. Here's an example. When we think of big game fishing, it depends on who the we is here, but when we think of big game fishing, we like to think of macho fishermen, and the first name that comes to mind, of course, is Ernest Hemingway. There's Hemingway in Cuba and in Bimini, and he is devoting himself. This is what he did when he wasn't writing, and sometimes when he should have been writing. But what he did was he went big game fishing. The favorite prey of Ernest Hemingway were marlins and swordfish, closely related but not the same. And so when Hemingway wrote about his big game fishing exploits, which he did, he wrote it it wasn't him in Old Man in the Sea, it was the old man who caught a great big marlin and the sharks ate most of it. But in Islands in the Stream, it's all about big game fishing, a Hemingway novel. And in this novel, Hemingway talks endlessly about how powerful, how strong, how huge he is. He, not Hemingway, the fish. The fish is a big, macho fish. And Hemingway actually is quoted as a fisherman is talking to his son in the book. He's quoted as saying, it has to be a he because no she, this is Hemingway talking, no she could possibly be that strong. No she could possibly be that aggressive. Turns out Hemingway was dead wrong.
Right.
Because every, not just some, every large swordfish and every large marlin, as it turns out, always, every single time, female. The males of swordfish, the males of marlin, may be maximum a quarter the size and a quarter the weight of the females. So they hear these guys flexing their muscles and standing there in the front of this big dead fish and being quoted as saying, I got the king of the sea this time. I conquered him, the king of the sea. It would be a little different. The whole history of big game fishing would be different if every time they stood in front of one of these huge 1,000-pound fish, they had to say, oh, I'm sorry I killed this mama. Maybe it would have had some nice babies until I reeled it in and posed in front of it. It's just an extraordinary sideline. Tuna, which grow to be as big, bluefin tuna grow to be as big. Males and females are the same size. Here, for whatever reason, and one can get into very serious trouble in a discussion of the reasons for the way things evolved, because they evolved the way they did because they did, not because they needed. Birds didn't develop wings so they could fly.
Right.
Fish didn't develop fins so they could swim. Somehow or other, these things that stuck out and they used became part of their modus operandi. But there's no purpose to it. There's no idea that if you develop a sword, you can do this or do that or stab whales. So here you have large females, only large females. And why? I don't know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Philip on the line in Plano. Hi, Philip.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is an absolutely fascinating subject, and I think someone once said we know more about deep space than we know about the deep sea, which leads to my question. You said that the swordfish goes up to the surface and then down 2,000-3,000 feet, and how in the world does the fish deal with the change in water pressure? And fascinating question. Well, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, they deal with the change in water pressure because they have no air spaces. The thing that happens to mammals, of which swordfish are not, the things that happen to mammals is they have lungs, they have sinuses, they have spaces that would have to be compressed by the pressure. But for all intents and purposes, except for some minor parts and their eyes, swordfish are made out of water. So water doesn't compress, as you know. So here's this creature that can rise up and down and not be affected by the pressure. Keep in mind that there are dozens, hundreds, thousands of deep-sea creatures that live at incredible depths. I mean, I'm talking about 2,000 or 3,000 feet for the swordfish. There are fishes that live at 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet, where the pressure is, you know, as you remember from some of these Cousteau films, enough to crush a fiberglass teacup until it's the size of a golf ball. The pressure is terrific, but fishes, except those fishes that have air bladders, and the fishes that have air bladders are not deep-sea fishes. So once again, what you're looking at here in the swordfish and in many other deep-sea creatures, what you're looking at is creatures, and I don't like this word because I'm going to get in trouble for using it, but creatures that are designed to function at depth and come up to the surface. The thing that's so wonderful about the swordfish is not that it can withstand the pressure, but that it is a hunter at the surface and at the depths. There are very, very few animals of any kind, I mean, seals, sea lions, whales, that fulfill that criterion. Very few creatures that are, because all that slashing around small schools of herring takes place at the surface. Then they go down 2,000-3,000 feet, and they slash around in with little tiny fish called lanternfish that are about 4 or 5 inches long, and they eat a lot of those, too. So here is one of, I haven't really done the exclusionary research on this, but it's one of the animals that is as comfortable at the surface as a hunter as it is at depth.
Okay, we have an email here from Fred who wants to know, is the swordfish attracted to metallic or magnetic or electrical fields, and could that account for the ramming disoriented behavior?
Probably. The answer is probably, but it's many fish, certainly sharks, are attracted to electrical fields and to mechanical things. They're attracted to noise. They can hear them. But the problem with that is that it doesn't explain what happens next. Okay, assuming it's attracted to a submersible. Okay, it swims over there, sees the oil rig, sees the submersible, and then in its swordfish brain it says, I know what I'll do with this submersible. I think I'll stab it and kill myself. So it can be attracted. Yes, that probably happens. But why the next step should happen is not clear.
Okay, so talk about this. Swordfish, we are cautioned about eating swordfish because of the mercury issue. They eat smaller fish, so I suppose this is part of the reason. But talk about the mercury content in their bodies and the extent to which humans who might choose to eat swordfish ought to think about this.
Let me put it this way. People who eat swordfish ought to think about it all the time. If I were to tell you, as we sat down in a restaurant, or if I was cooking a meal for you, and I put something in front of you, and I said, hey, there's a little amount of arsenic in this. It won't kill you, but it's okay. What would you do? You'd say, arsenic? Are you kidding me?
Right.
I don't want that. I'm sending out for Chinese food. But there is mercury in swordfish. There's mercury in virtually all large predatory fishes. Large predatory fishes are sharks, tuna, swordfish, marlins, mahi-mahi. Any big fish that eat little fish is going to have mercury, and the reason for it is fairly obvious. Mercury comes out of the air, strangely. It comes from coal-fired electrical plants, most of which are in China. And the coal-fired electrical plants spew out all this horrible stuff into the air. It is carried by air currents until it gets heavy enough and falls. Well, most of the world is covered with water. We know that. So most of it is going to fall in the water. I mean, if it falls in the Himalayas, you're not really worried. If it falls in the middle of the Sahara Desert, you're not really worried. And there's a lot of Himalayas and a lot of Sahara Desert. There's also a lot of water. So it percolates down through the ocean, everywhere in the ocean, in the Arctic Ocean, in the Caribbean, in the South Pacific, everywhere. It percolates down where it is absorbed into the tissues of the smallest creatures, smallest bacteria in the ocean. They are then consumed by larger creatures. They are then consumed by larger creatures. And we're working our way up to shrimp and krill. And now we're at small fishes. And then we're at larger fishes. And finally we get to the largest fishes of all, swordfish, marlins, tuna, have been consuming a lot of mercury. And it accumulates. And it doesn't go anywhere. They don't work it out of their systems. stays there. Now, you can, the U.S. FDA has issued very strict guidelines for eating tuna, swordfish. Not very many people eat sharks, although they make a lot of soup out of shark fins. And they say pregnant women or women thinking about becoming pregnant should not eat tuna. This is all tuna, by the way. Tuna out of cans, bluefin tuna, sushi, all that. They shouldn't do it. They should not eat swordfish, too. But the argument, and it's not necessarily a bad one, the argument is that the fish itself contains omega-3 fatty acids, which are good for you. It doesn't contain all the cholesterol of red meat and all of those arguments as well. So people are willing to eat a small amount. If you ate swordfish three times a day, you wouldn't be able to walk after a while. It's happened with tuna, mostly. Swordfish. People don't eat swordfish three times a day, but people did eat tuna until they realized that they were getting mercury poisoning. So the answer is a complex one. The answer is, okay, have an occasional piece of swordfish. Do not have it three times a day, depending upon whether you're pregnant or how old you are. If you're 87 years old, probably isn't going to make a whole lot of difference. If you're 21 years old, you should not decide to make a full-time diet out of swordfish. But it won't kill you. And it's like that arsenic parable. Okay, there's a little arsenic in it. You want to eat it? It tastes really good? Okay, I'll eat it.
Richard Ellis is with us. He's a painter of marine natural history and author of the new book Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard Ellis, whose new book is called Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I'm curious about this, Richard. You did a number of the illustrations in the book, drawings and paintings. Are there things that you learn about a particular species when you sit down to capture it in an illustration that you wouldn't necessarily think about in the same way if you were just writing about it?
Yes, is the answer. And I think when I begin a painting, and I've done a lot of paintings of deep sea and open ocean creatures, whales, sharks, whatever, it seems to me that one of the more important things to be able to communicate in this painting is where the animal lives. In other words, I don't have a map or an email address, but I have, is it a deep water animal? Is it near the surface? And if so, how does it, how has it evolved for this particular lifestyle? I don't fish, not because I don't want to catch the big females, but I don't fish anyway, even though people assume that I ought to with my great interest in fish and the sea, but I don't. But what happens when you look at these things in photographs, in film, a lot of these fishes have been filmed, except for swordfish. You get a sense of what they actually look like. I mean, it's the same sort of thing that bird watchers use to identify birds at a distance. There's a characteristic, tilt of the head, a wing pattern, and you learn what this animal really looks like, and then it is the way you try and portray it. You try and portray it in a way that, for want of a better term, feels like a swordfish, or feels like a great white shark, or feels like a big whale in the water. And it's very difficult, obviously, to communicate the size of it. I mean, I'm working with a canvas, let's say, that is 36 inches long, and I'm trying to show a fish, or a whale for that matter, that's 100 feet long, not a fish, but a whale, that's 100 feet long. So you get a sense of, you try and communicate what it actually looks like. And this gives you information on how it lives and how it functions. What I was saying is that I don't fish, but I admire these creatures. I admire them enormously. And even though I don't fish, I capture them in paint, or I hope in words as well. My idea of how to pay my respects, if you will, to a swordfish or a great white shark or a giant squid or whatever, is to paint a picture of it that becomes then a part of the a part of the literature, so that other people get a sense of what this animal is supposed to look like. That's not to say that there are other people who don't paint well and who don't capture the image of the fish, but this is what I want to do. I don't shoot anything either, but I capture things. I capture them on canvas. I capture them in words, and I want to be able to get the word out, if you will, that these are wonderful animals, and the wonder of them is what intrigues me in the first place, and I just hope I'm communicating that.
Is it your hope, Richard, that by reading your books, looking at your paintings and drawings, that other people might be convinced that that's enough and that they don't need one of these things mounted on their den wall?
Well, if they wanted to get, this is a complex question, if they wanted to get one of these things mounted on the den wall, they wouldn't have the fish that they caught. Because what they figured out, what the taxidermists figured out a long time ago, is it's very messy and unnecessary for the fisherman to take his 7-foot sailfish and wrap it up in plastic and put it in a box and mail it to a taxidermist. What they do now is they call up the taxidermist and they say, 7-foot sailfish caught off Mexico, and the taxidermist makes a fiberglass model of a 7-foot sailfish.
Really?
The color of one. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because they don't stuff fish. Mm-hmm. Even at the Museum of Natural History, where I worked for many years in New York, all the fishes in the Hall of the Biology of Fishes were plaster models, and now they've become fiberglass casts of the plaster models. But you don't want to stuff a fish and hang it up on your living room wall. But now to get back to why anybody would want to do that and whether or not my books have any effect, I would hope so. I would hope that, I mean, somebody once asked me why I do this in the first place. I've been doing it for a long time. I started at the Natural History Museum in New York, where I designed the whale for the Natural History Museum, the big iconic blue whale that's in the hall of ocean life. And from there, I began working with other types of animals, sharks, fishes, squid, whales. And what I have intended to do over this long period of time is to have people look at the paintings or read the book and say, wow, I didn't know that. And that's fascinating. And the rest of that sentence is supposed to be, wow, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Why are we killing these things? I wanted, and I was on the Whaling Commission for many years, involved with the preservation of whales. But I wanted that to stop, not necessarily politically, but because I look at these things as subjects for art, as part of the world in which we live, as fascinating creatures. And I wanted people to, as I say, I wanted people to say, hey, we don't have to kill these things. Look at how wonderful dolphins are, for example. The Japanese are still killing them. You know, that film that was made of the Cove was fabulous. Won an Academy Award. Everybody loved the whole idea. Did the Japanese stop doing it? No. Are they still killing Are they still killing dolphins in the same place? You bet.
And we should say the swordfish that are being taken from the oceans are getting smaller and smaller with each passing decade.
That is true because surface fishermen often target the larger one. And as I say, they're going to be the female. So if you start taking the large females out of the population, you're going to not reduce the size. The fish don't shrink, but they don't have an opportunity to grow as big anymore. And off New England, for example, they are still harpooning swordfish. I've been on swordfish boats out of Little Compton, Rhode Island, where people would stand in a kind of an extended, what was called a pulpit, with a harpoon in their hand. And they spot a swordfish at the surface. They drive the boat over there. The guy throws the harpoon at it. They do the same thing with tuna in the same area, by the way. But they're the large ones. You don't even see the little ones. So they're taking out the larger ones if they can. But let me follow that by saying that most swordfish are not harpooned off Rhode Island. Most swordfish are caught on long lines, the fishing that you saw in The Perfect Storm, and they're caught by the hundreds and the thousands in the Pacific and in the Atlantic as well. Swordfish are very, very widely distributed. But the good news is that they're also very prolific. They lay a lot of eggs. We've never seen swordfish breeding. We don't know how it works. I mean, we have a pretty good idea of how it works. But there's a lot of them out there. And there have been some areas where sword fishing has been banned. In Florida, for example, some parts of Florida, sword fishing was, it's not anymore, but swordfish fishing was illegal.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Richard. If fishermen can find these things and pull them out by the hundreds or the thousands at a time, why are they so elusive to scientists and their cameras and their submersibles and whatever technologies they might use to study them in the
world?
Well,
think of The Perfect Storm. Think of where the fishermen do this. Remember, these long lines are not, they're not reminiscent of Huck Finn sitting on the bank with a bent pin. These are way down deep in the ocean. All this is happening way down. Mm-hmm. They are elusive in that, well, nobody has ever seen or filmed a swordfish feeding. They filmed marlins. People have seen this, and people are going to call and say, yeah, well, I saw these sailfish and marlins charging a bait ball. Yeah, they do, but it's just never been seen with swordfish. There's a lot of them. All longline fishing is open ocean fishing. I mean, this is the way it works. You deploy a long line, and long is almost an oxymoron. Long lines can be 40 miles long. Hmm. And every couple of feet, there's a hook, a baited hook. And they just leave them out there. They go away. Then they come back, and they haul in 40 miles of line, and there are a lot of fish on these lines. There are a lot of sharks and turtles and dolphins and albatrosses. A whole bunch of stuff also gets pulled in. I suppose one could devote a certain amount of time to sign on to a swordfish longliner if it didn't get hit by a perfect storm. And you'd go to where they're fishing, but all you would be able to see is a swordfish taking a baited hook. Usually happens at night anyway. So the answer is, the question was a good one. Why don't people see them doing these things? And unfortunately, because people don't set out to do that.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have John on the line in Carrollton. Hello, John.
Hi. I was listening to you earlier mentioning about the swordfish attacking things, and it made me think of the fish like the betta fighting fish, where if they see another one, they're very territorial, and they'll attack. So could they be seeing a reflection of themselves, like off the guy's camera or off the metal of whatever they're attacking?
Could be. Could be. I mean, you don't see a reflection of yourself in a whale, and the guy's camera, you would have to have greater faith in the eye of a swordfish to imagine that it could see a swordfish in the lens of a camera. But maybe that is. But the problem is that it didn't see its reflection in an oil rig. It didn't see its reflection in the submersible Alvin. Bettas do that. Bettas fight swordfish, as far as we know, don't. They don't fight. Well, I mean, we don't know that because we've never seen them not fighting. But they don't duel. They don't joust with each other, we don't think. Maybe they do. Maybe that's the answer. Just that nobody's ever seen that either. We don't know. We don't know why they would attack all these various. They also, in the Second World War, when there were troop ships and supply ships in the Pacific, in particularly off South Africa, they were bringing rubber in, and these ships would be torpedoed, and large bales of rubber would be dumped in the ocean after the ship was torpedoed. When they hauled in the bales of rubber, they found swordfish swords embedded in them. There's something aggressive about what the swordfish is doing, but we can't really figure it out. It may be any large thing, maybe. I'm certainly making this up. That's not biologically sound either. But they may just be threatened by any object larger than they are, even though Mark Ferrari wasn't larger than the fish that stabbed him.
What do we know, Richard, about how swordfish have been affected by changes in the condition of the ocean?
We know very little about that, but we do know that swordfish are dependent, as many fishes are dependent upon water temperature for breeding. The temperature has to be exactly right for them to spawn. And while there has not been, in fact, there's been an increase in the number of swordfish, we think, and you know this because they're catching more rather than fewer, we believe that changes in ocean temperature or ocean acidity will probably affect the breeding of fishes in the sea. Obviously, it stands to reason that if a creature has been over millennia breeding in certain circumstances, certain salinity, certain acidity, certain temperature, you change that, something is probably going to happen. We don't know what it is, but I think it is as good a subject for convincing people of global warming. In other words, you don't want to wait and say, hey, I wonder what happened to the swordfish. The temperature only got a half a degree warmer. I can't understand it. We're not finding any more swordfish. Could be that. Could in the future. It isn't that now, but it could be. So there are all these cascading possibilities with global warming that things happen that we can't even begin to predict. In the swordfish book, though, because we do know that swordfish breed in certain places because of the conditions are suitable for their breeding, the temperature's going up. The numbers haven't gone down, but they haven't gone down yet. They may.
Richard Ellis is a painter of marine natural history and author of the new book Swordfish, a biography of the ocean gladiator. Richard, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones and helped with producing as well today. Christine McConnell does our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.